Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday. It's December 6th, 27 degrees here in Old Town Park City. We've got some clouds, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. And yes, it is a quite chilly start to our day, but we do expect to have some temperatures hanging around those 40s as we continue throughout the afternoon hours. And we'll start to see that we have a system bringing in the chance of some snow showers for us as we go into the later parts of the day. So that is something to keep in mind, especially if we're traveling. Could lead to some slick roads as we go into the overnight hours for tonight. The snow still hangs around for a bit, slowly tapers out as we get into the morning hours. 27 degrees will be our low. Tuesday, we still have that chance of some high elevation snow showers still hanging around as well. 41 degrees will be our high once again. Going into Tuesday, we'll see that system completely exit out of our area, no longer seeing much in the way of any kind of precipitation, just partly cloudy skies with a low of 25 degrees. Wednesday, we expect to see another little quick moving system bring by some cloud cover, maybe a few flurries of snow for the mountaintops. Not really going to see much ourselves as we go in, as we have a high of 43 for us on Wednesday. Going to Wednesday night, we begin to see the making of another system starting to move in, bringing us some snow once again. 28 will be the low for Wednesday night. Going into Thursday, we'll see that we do have heavier snow chances moving in with a much stronger and colder system. We'll have a high of 35 degrees. We are expecting to see that snow hang around for Thursday night with a low of 14 due to the much cooler air, and we can expect to see accumulations of 4 to 8 inches possible for the entire day of Thursday. Friday, we'll see a chance of snow still occurring with those mostly cloudy skies and much cooler temperatures, a high of only 23 degrees. We won't get anywhere near that freezing mark. And as we go into Friday night, the snow starts to taper out. Again, that system moves on over towards the east, and we'll have cloud cover hanging around with a low of 8 degrees. Saturday, we're expecting to see mostly sunny skies. 28 degrees will be our high. We'll see cloud cover still hanging around for Saturday night at 15 for our low. Sunday, again, mostly sunny, slightly warmer though. We'll have a high of 39 as we continue into the weekend. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo.
All right.
Leslie, back to you.
Thanks, Cesar. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Park City businesswoman Natalie Pepito. She's got details about a town hall meeting to discuss Senate Bill 2004 and the impacts on small businesses. Then Park City troublemaker Renee Moxhall with details on their holiday concert coming up this weekend, as well as the cancellation of the Park City Singers concerts this year. Finally, Park City High School debate team members Noam Levinsky and Grant Murray will be in to talk about their season so far, their efforts to raise money, and more. Well, as the dust settles from a record-setting public input session last week about a proposed new neighborhood at Kimball Junction, KPCW's Alexander Kramer has details about what we learned.
The number of people who showed up to a hearing about a controversial development Wednesday evening may have broken attendance records. But if an online petition opposing the project was any guide, that could have been expected. As of Friday, more than 4,000 people had signed their names. Dakota Pacific Real Estate wants to build 1,100 homes at Kimball Junction, along with offices and a hotel. Opponents of the plan decried the traffic the project would create and the congestion of adding 3,000 residents to the area. Proponents, on the other hand, say the project could fast-track needed and costly traffic fixes for SR-224. A 2008 agreement that governs the land restricts what can be built there to mostly tech-related businesses. Dakota Pacific is asking the county council to relax those restrictions, which it has wide latitude to do. The opposition petition's organizer, Ulrich Binzer, said on Wednesday everyone who signed it supplied an address in the Snyderville Basin, marking them as likely voters for county council seats.
So right now, doing my math, at least 50% of your voters are definitely against this. If I was a politician, I would do a very simple analysis. Okay. If I vote for this, everyone's going to hate me. If I vote against it, everyone's going to think I'm a hero. And I get reelected, I will be a hero forever when I retire in Park City. So why are we making this so difficult?
Council Chair Glenn Wright and Vice Chair Chris Robinson are both up for re-election in 2022. Wright has repeatedly said this will be his last term as a councilor. Robinson, who is the longest-serving councilor and was first elected in 2008, said he hadn't decided whether to seek another term. Wright has been a proponent of the project, while Robinson's opinion is less clear. Earlier this year, there was a vote among councilors to direct county staff to prepare a detailed development agreement. Robinson and Wright joined with Councillors Doug Clyde and Melina Stevens in voting for the proposal. Only Councillor Roger Armstrong dissented, and his opposition has remained steadfast. The vote was seen as reflecting councillors' support for the project. The conventional wisdom has been that four councillors support the proposal and only Armstrong does not, but that was before the recent groundswell of opposition. On Friday, Wright told KPCW he is generally supportive of the project, but said it was still a work in process. Robinson initially recused himself from the deliberations because he'd received Utah Jazz tickets from a vice president of Dakota Pacific Real Estate who has been closely involved in this project. Robinson has taken a lead role in recent negotiations since unrecusing himself, serving on a subcommittee with Clyde. Both councillors have significant development experience, Clyde in planning and developing ski areas and Robinson as a vast property owner, rancher, and housing developer himself. It was Robinson who in recent meetings explained the intricacies of the financial aspects of the plan. The Dakota Pacific proposal involves complicated finance mechanisms, including a public infrastructure district, which is a voluntary agreement to levy money from property owners. It could raise up to $14 million to be earmarked for transit solutions. Robinson has outlined both the project's pros and cons in public meetings. Clyde has generally been a proponent. He has said a chief argument of the opposition, that the tech center won't be built, isn't true. Anything with an entitlement in this area, he said earlier this year, would likely be built. On Wednesday, he described his thinking in more detail.
You know, when I was driving in this afternoon, they were probably waiting through three lights to get out, right? That's where we are currently. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of units left to be developed inside of the boundary of the Kimball Junction area. How are we going to get that traffic through Kimball Junction?
The key, he said, is an HTRZ, or a Housing and Transit Reinvestment Zone. There are two benefits if the state agrees to establish an HTRZ around the Dakota Pacific project site. For one, the county is empowered to collect 80% of the tax increment created inside the area. That could help pay for costly transit fixes. The other is that an HTRZ requires the Utah Department of Transportation to, quote, give priority consideration to projects that are within the boundaries. That's according to the legislation sponsoring the HTRZ. Instruments like the HTRZ and the Public Infrastructure District are how county councillors say solutions like burying SR-224, which could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, would be accomplished.
I believe that the importance of the HTZ zone is the linchpin on this entire thing. If we can't find that is a commitment that they can make and that they can live with and that we can take to the bank, as it were, then there's no reason to do this.
This didn't sit well with the anti-development crowd still around to hear Clyde's comments around 10:45. Melina Stevens, meanwhile, is the only county councillor who previously voted on the proposal. She was one of two Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioners to vote for the project when, by a 5-2 margin, the commission forwarded a negative recommendation to the county council last fall. At the time, she favored loosening the tech-related restrictions on the land. She said she was comparing the proposal not to open space, as it currently is, but to the tech center it was approved to become. Wright said he wasn't sure there would be a vote by the end of the year. The council has two more meetings in December and must approve its operating budget, which is proposed to be the largest ever. Alexander Kramer, KPCW News.
Senate Bill 2004 was signed November 16th. It enacts provisions related to COVID-19 vaccination and testing in the workplace. A town hall meeting will be held on Tuesday from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rockwell Room on Park City's Main Street. The meeting has been called by Natalie Pepito, a small business owner of a daycare center. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So maybe could you just start by explaining what Senate Bill 2004 requires of small business owners in the state?
Okay, so basically, Senate Bill 2004 was signed into law on November the 16th, and it basically tells employers that they can't fire an employee or a prospective employee if they require or they want a vaccine exemption in the workplace. And it also makes the employer pay for any kind of COVID testing in the workplace.
So is this a bill that you support as a small business owner?
I'm just a supporter of choice. That's all. That's my whole thing, is just choice. It's none of my business as far as who's vaccinated or not. And so I just want the choice.
So why did you call this town hall meeting then?
Oh, because our group basically kind of came up with the idea of doing a bill or speaking to our legislators, and this little seed of an idea became a law eventually. So these speakings happened back in July at a meeting. So we do a weekly meeting, and we talk about different things, and we talked about preventing a vaccine passport situation in the workplace, basically. We just want the choice. So if you're vaccinated, cool. If you're not, cool. That kind of thing. You know, so that's how it started.
Well, the group you're talking about is the Summit County Freedom Group?
Yes.
Yeah, which basically is against all vaccine and mask mandates?
No. No. I don't care if anyone's masked around me or anything. That's my personal opinion, though. We're not Democrat or Republican. We're just medical freedom. That's just choice, the choice.
And I think, I mean, your website says that government and business have no place dictating what goes on to our into our bodies.
True.
Right?
Yes.
Except that you put everybody at risk who then comes into your path.
No? That's your opinion.
But that doesn't sound like freedom. It sounds like you're being just very selfish.
You can call selfish both ways, because there are people that are injured with vaccines as well, and they're not given a chance as well. But I just want to talk about the town hall, because it's neither here nor there, this debate. You know what I'm saying? So it's just freedom of choice. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah. So what kind of turnout are you expecting?
Oh, we're expecting about 100 people, 150 people. That's all that the venue will hold, so we can't go anything past that.
Yeah. So the email says that if your business doesn't understand this new law, you could be opening your door to lawsuits. How so?
Well, if you've been following courts and what's been going on in the courts, you know, anyone can say you have to mandate a vaccine, right? And the government isn't liable per se. So a small business, so say like the federal courts start doing injunctions and saying, no, this is unconstitutional, you can't do that. So if people decide to file a lawsuit because they feel like that they're being discriminated against, then that falls on the small business. Does that make sense? You know, so it's just protection. And it's protection against being a government enforcer of mandates that aren't laws.
All right. So isn't it as a small business owner in your best interest to make sure that your employees are protected? And we know that that's what vaccines do, is protect people from, you know, staying out of the hospital for the most part.
Well, if you look at other data, there's other data out there, but I'm not here to debate that today. I'm here just to talk about the town hall and to just say this is just a celebration of Senate Bill 2004 that became signed into law. That's it.
Yeah. That's how do you feel about the bill, though, that does require for the COVID testing? I mean, if
businesses require it, then they pay for it. No big deal, in my opinion. If an employee chooses to work for that company and they have to be tested, then so be it. That's the way I look at it. As long as the employer pays for it. So that's part of the law.
Okay. I mean, as a small business owner, how are you? I mean, is that something you're willing to do then, is to pay for the COVID testing?
Well, I'm a one-person show. And my daycare is in my home, so it's very small. I used to have two businesses, and then I closed them down just because I'm 50 and I want to downsize, and I just want to be me, and I don't want to have to rely on staff and the reliability and all that stuff. So it was just a personal choice on mine. So I'm a one-person show.
So
it doesn't apply to me, really.
Will you have an employment attorney there? I mean, just to kind of answer some of those legal questions about the potential for small business owners, though?
No, it's more of a celebration, and it's just kind of just the factual. And if anyone wants to delve into it more, then of course they can dig further for themselves, in my opinion.
Okay, so you're celebrating what?
We're celebrating just the fact that a little group of people thought up of something, and it went through the process of legislation, and it became a law. Just a group of people. That's it. That's what we're celebrating, that local action actually has some national impact sometimes.
All right. So talk to me a little bit more about this organization, Summit County Freedom. When did it come into... When did you guys start?
We're almost a year old, and it just began. I'm not the founder of it. I'm just a member. And it just was, it started off with our founder, Ryan Sternagle, and he had a couple of friends of his, and they started meeting up once a week. And then all the things started happening, you know, last winter. And then our group just started growing. Little by little.
Yeah. How big are you?
We're about 300 households strong.
Okay. And you now meet monthly?
We meet weekly. Yeah. So we meet once a week, and we've been meeting once a week for almost a year.
Okay. And when and where does that happen?
Well, it's at different people's houses, so I don't really disclose the addresses. So it's just a weekly meeting, and we just talk about things on our agenda that we're working on at the time.
So what else have you got on that agenda?
Right now, it's just basically Senate Bill 2004, and now the holidays are happening, so we're kind of just hanging out. Does that make sense? So we didn't have a meeting for Thanksgiving, and our last meeting was about the town hall, so we were organizing that. And then we're actually talking about the Dakota Pacific Project as well, so we went and attended that council meeting on Wednesday. So we just, various things. It's just not about masks and vaccines. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. So how does somebody get involved in the organization?
Well, we have a website, which I know you saw. It's www.summitcountyfreedom.com, and there's an opt-in email list.
All right. So again, if somebody's interested in participating in the December 7th town hall meeting, do they just show up or do they need to register?
There's an Eventbrite link. So in the flyer that I gave you, there's a little scanner, the QR code. And then if you go on the website, it's on the homepage that you can actually click on the Eventbrite link. It's free. There will be light fare. So appies and coffee and tea.
Okay.
And then I think if you want to get alcohol, I think you go downstairs to the OP Rockwells.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
Nothing. That's it. This is the first time I'm on a radio, so it was very cool.
All right. Natalie, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Park City businesswoman Natalie Pepito. Again, that town hall meeting happening tomorrow there at O.P. Rockwell's room starting at 6 o'clock. Well, at a community forum on Friday, the local senior community began to formulate a wish list for potential future housing projects. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
Although the ultimate fate of the Park City Senior Center on Woodside Avenue has gotten the lion's share of attention in recent years, the issue of senior housing was the centerpiece of Friday's forum. Billed as a listening session by city staff and Senior Center board member Cheryl Sosnick, dozens of local seniors filled the Park City Library's community room to provide feedback. Many ideas were tossed around, but a few kept popping up. One in particular was to provide realistic options for people looking to move out of a larger house and still stay in the area. Chris Roon said he relocated from the Bay Area 16 years ago to escape the city, but he now feels like there's nowhere for he and his wife to go when they eventually downsize from their current home in Park Meadows.
I want a place where I don't have to leave all my friends. I'm 65. I just joined Medicare. Lucky me. 10 years from now,
your kid.
I don't want to try to maintain the home I have, but I don't have a choice. And a lot of my neighbors in Park Meadows don't have a choice. I want a place I can stay in the county, and I don't have that option. And it has to be single level living, and I have to have access to transit.
Other ideas suggested were better integrating community areas into future housing projects, incorporating larger kitchens for visiting family or assisted living staff, and prioritizing access for longtime residents over more recent transplants. A big question that was answered on Friday was whether or not to offer future senior housing units as rentals. By a show of hands, the room was overwhelmingly in favor of renting future units over buying them. Pat Matheson is the executive director of the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust and said although concrete plans for a future project might be a ways away, the feedback received now is invaluable for when designs do get drawn up.
I think that talking about community rooms, number of bedrooms, parking accessibility, it seems like you're getting ahead of yourself in some degree, but you're really not. Because when you express those needs and desires now, it starts to formulate what might be possible. So I think the more things that come out, they're sort of specific to use and size and things like that, really help everybody else to wrap their heads around what a project might look like.
Ultimately, the seniors decided to take the feedback from Friday's session and form an action committee of themselves, elected officials, staff, and other members of the community to determine a clear path forward. Dubbed a Gray Ribbon Committee by People's Health Clinic Executive Director Beth Armstrong, the committee will work to zero in on things like size, location, and amenities for future housing projects geared towards the senior community. Current City Councilor and Mayor-elect Nan Worrell closed the forum by reflecting on her prior work on senior issues and pledging her support to the senior community and the future committee.
I have been very frustrated over the years. I started my career here in Park City at the People's Health Clinic and participated in some conversations, and that was probably 15 years ago, trying to get some traction for senior services. And I've been very frustrated over the years that that has not happened. I am so encouraged today. I'm so excited today. I've taken some notes. I've listened intently to your comments. And I thank you all for being here. I thank you for your interest. I will pledge to you my support for whatever efforts need to come next. And Beth, I'd be honored to be part of your committee.
The city and the senior community are also poised to re-engage over the proposed housing project at the site of the current senior center, known as the Woodside Phase 2 project, once Worrell takes office early next year. The project stalled earlier this year after the senior community voted to not leave the site, and the city council expressed a desire to integrate the senior center into future housing projects at a meeting last month. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Troublemakers are preparing for an upcoming holiday concert in the studio. To tell us more, I have singer Renee Moxhall. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the air this morning.
Sure. So the Park City Troublemakers are their own group. They're not part of Park City Singers.
That is correct.
Tell us a little bit about the group.
We are now in our 10th year, and we are a 16-member women's a cappella ensemble. So we perform without a piano accompaniment, which is a real challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge, and it does allow us to perform in a number of settings without needing a gigantic piano that often is not available. So it makes us very versatile, performing for various groups. And so just this year, we've been all about town, and in the past 10 years as well, we've performed all around town, both a spring repertoire and a Christmas or a holiday repertoire.
Okay. So the Park City Singers at one point thought they were going to start performing, but
yes,
changed their minds? Because are you on both of them?
You're
a singer and a troublemaker.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I do sing with both. Our director of singers determined that at that time, that was the Delta variant of the COVID virus, that he felt was too dangerous to proceed with the season.
That's a much bigger group. Is that part of it?
It is a bigger group, yes, yes. At times, we were as many as 60. So it is a much bigger group. Among our 16 of our ensemble, our a cappella ensemble, we are all vaccinated. So we felt that it was safe to go ahead, and we're certainly glad that we were able to do so, because I think a lot of our community depended on the singers' concert as a holiday tradition. And it would be very unfortunate, I think, if there wasn't a local group that's performing traditional holiday music. Ours is traditional, I will say that, but it also has some very elaborate spins to it. Some of the music is really very different than what you would have heard a traditional holiday song presented before. I mean, a lot of these songs are very familiar, like Jingle Bells. How much more common could that be? But this is a very different arrangement. So it's a lot of fun. And I think sometimes because it is a cappella, you can go quite a ways out of the traditional arrangements and have a very original composition to perform.
All right. Well, who's the conductor? I mean, who directs you?
Colleen Earnshaw, and she's absolutely wonderful. She also is very expert at choosing the music that we perform. I have been told by many people that we have never been better this season than in ever before. So I'm feeling very confident about the way we sound this year.
Yeah. How often do you, the Troublemakers, practice?
We rehearse together once a week. However, all week long, I think that I speak for each of us that we practice, I know myself, every day. It just has to be part of my daily existence so that because all of our music is memorized. I should mention that as well. All of our music is memorized. So it does kind of require a consistent practice schedule.
Yeah. And the singers, I think, is a community. You invite everybody to participate.
That is correct.
Troublemakers,
yes.
I mean, is there some kind of tryout then?
Oh, yes. Yes. It is an audition ensemble.
All right. Well, tell us then about this week's concert then. You're going to have just one, huh?
One community concert. We do have a salon concert that is on the 18th. And actually, there are still some tickets available for that one as well. It's in a private home. And we serve sparkling beverages and appetizers, so it is a little more expensive. But that one is also mentioned on our website. And on the website is where you can find purchase information for either of our concerts. And I'll mention it again at the end of this interview, but it is parkcitytroublemakers.org. And as I say, there is information about how to purchase the concert tickets on that website.
Okay. So the one that's open to everyone, when and where is that?
That is this coming Sunday, December 12th, 4 p.m. at Park City Community Church. We are charging $15 for adults at the door. It's $12 if you manage to do the advance sale on the website. We'll also be selling tickets at Newcomers Holiday Brunch, which is Wednesday at the Christian Center. And I think anyone could just pop in and buy some tickets if they want to. We will be there, and you'll notice us. We're all dressed alike.
Okay. Any COVID precautions that people need to know about?
Yes. We are requiring masks. That came about just so recently as this Omicron virus variant began to develop. So the church does require masks to be worn. So we will require that for our community concert and our salon concert, both.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to let us know?
I think that covers the basics of it. Like I say, we are performing all around, and we will again in the spring be all about town, and we would look forward to seeing Park City at any of our concerts,
okay,
both holiday and spring.
The Park City singers themselves, we're just kind of on a wait and see, huh, in terms
yes,
of when they get back.
Yes. We singers only put together a Christmas concert for the last several years. So it will be a full year or before any sort of a concert would likely occur with them. And I guess it's just, like you say, wait and see.
Okay. Renee, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's Renee Moxhall again with the Park City Troublemakers. Two Park City High School seniors, Noam Levinsky and Grant Murray, participate in the school's debate team. They join me now in the studio to talk about the team's performance this season, their hopes for the championships, and a particularly prestigious award received last month at the tournament held in Minneapolis. Grant and Noam, join me now in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay. Noam, do you want to start just by giving us a little bit of background on the debate team? Is it for all for 9 to 12 grade? Do you have to take tryout or do you take a special
class?
Yeah,
there are no tryouts. There is a debate class at the high school, which is really useful if you want to join the team. But anybody can join, which is, I think, is one of the best parts of the team, is that it's super accessible no matter what your interests are or like what skill level you're coming in with.
Okay, so again, it's for 9-12 grade?
9 through 12. It's kind of tough for 9th graders to join just because it is hosted at the high school building. But if you want to come over from Treasure, you're totally allowed to.
Okay. So it's a club that meets after school?
Yep, after school on Wednesdays.
All right. And you have an advisor?
Yeah. So Miss Williams at the high school is our advisor. And then we also have Duncan Stewart, who's an adjunct professor at the University of Utah, who's our head coach.
Ah, okay. Grant, you tell us, and we'll get it from both of you. I mean, why is it something you participate in?
Personally, I really enjoy, like, the intellectual conversations that we form, not only with, like, our team, but with, like, others around, like, Utah and, like, around the nation, essentially, right? It's the only place, really, where we can compete with argumentative skills and just be on that same wavelength as well, right?
Yeah, and how about for you, Noam?
I think Grant definitely, like, hit it perfectly right there. My favorite part of debate is it's one of the few places in high school where you can have a lot of intellectual freedom, where usually our learning is very much bounded by curriculum. In debate, we have these kind of broad topics, and you can really research into those however you want to. So it enables high school students to look into academic topics that interest them, which is just really cool, because that kind of intellectual freedom usually doesn't exist until later in life.
Yep. So, I mean, when you think about debate, is it about arguing?
It's not all about arguing. It's a two kind of skill-based event, right? One is obviously the argumentation, but the other one is, like, persuasion, right? If you can convince, like, others, like the judge in your debate round, that you are winning, like, an argument, then it's like, oh, you're developing your persuasion skills as well. And it's also, like, the social skills as well. You also have to be, like, good with talking with people and, like, you know, not actively trying to, like, make them mad, but also, like, try to like you, you know? You have to be likable as well.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, is it persuading somebody? Is it with the truth? Or can you just basically say whatever you want and try to persuade somebody?
You can definitely say whatever you want. And obviously, it's easier to persuade someone if what you're saying is actually true. But the great thing about debate is that it is accessible for a wide range of people, because if you're a persuasive person but you struggle with that technical argumentation, there are types of debate where you can do where it's really all speaking based. But if you're also not as good of a speaker but you're really good with things like research and argumentation, there are other forms of debate you can do that value that much more heavily. So it definitely depends on how you're debating, but ultimately it's kind of a mix between the two.
All right, so Noam, you're the one that actually likes to do these one-on-one debates, and then Grant, you're the one that does the speeches?
Mm-hmm.
The speeches, before I get back to you, the speeches then, are those done something that you prepare, or is it just something that you're thrown, that, you know, judges throw out a topic and it's like you go from there?
There's a couple main types, but the two main types that I participate in are impromptu and student congress. And with impromptu, it's all given to you in like 7 minutes. You're given a topic and you have to think of a speech on the fly and give a good persuasive speech in the time you're given. And it's really hard to do that because, well, not everyone's good at like making those on-the-fly speeches. But particularly, I enjoy that a lot.
Well, yeah, if you were funny, you could be a stand-up comedian, right? I mean, right? I mean,
yeah.
there's it's very close, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are some of the topics that you have, that these impromptu speeches that you've given?
Oh, it can be on, like, anything. The most recent one I got was, like, how, you know, it was, like, just a movie, right? It was, like, Cinderella, and I had to make a speech on that, right? And the speech I gave was talking about the glass slipper and, like, how it's representative of, like, you know, showing your true self and identity, right? And so you're given these, like, really off-the-wall topics, and you have to, like, make this cohesive sort of speech to make it sound good, right? And it has to be usually on, like, a broad topic that people can relate to.
Yeah, so is that something that you then... you've got 7 minutes. I mean, is it something that you write down, or you just kind of put some bullet points to yourself to...
Yeah, so with that, you're usually given a topic, and you're, like, given 7 minutes to do with however you please. Usually you want to use, like, a minute of that to prep, right? And then you usually want to write down bullet points, because you can't bring up anything when you give a speech. It has to be off the top of your head. You can write ideas down, but as soon as you're up there, you're on your own. And I think that's the really impressive part, seeing really good impromptuers, especially at Park City High School, just, like, stand up and give these amazing speeches off the top of their head with, like, no forewarning.
Okay. So, Noam, then, again, you like this one-on-one, and that's how does that work? One-on-one
yeah,
debate.
So I primarily do Lincoln-Douglas debate, which is one-on-one. The rounds last about 45 minutes, and we have one topic for each period of 2 months. So right now our current topic is resolved. A just government ought to recognize the unconditional right of workers to strike. So you basically flip a coin before the round to determine what side you're on. And then the affirmative debater goes in and supports that topic. with like textual evidence from research studies and scholars and things like that, and then the negative does the same thing, but on the other side. So it's very different from impromptu in that it's all pre-prepared and really evidence-based, and also that it's all of this one-on-one clash where it's very head-on argumentation, and it's a lot less focus on how well you're speaking, but more the arguments you're making.
All right, so you have time to know both sides of it then. What if it's something that, how do you make those arguments? I mean, if you didn't believe that people have the right to strike?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because most topics, one of the sides I really strongly disagree with. And the way I do that is that either, there are kind of two approaches. One is that you stretch the topic and kind of think of a really creative interpretation of it so you can stick to your political beliefs on both sides of it. Or the other way is just to kind of switch back and forth. And debaters have different views on this about, right, like for, I think a lot of debaters do tend to lean left sometimes, right? So like if you're on a more right-leaning side of the topic, do you embrace that? Or do you have some like crazy piece of evidence that makes it go left? And I think both of those can be strategic and both of those can be legitimate, but those are kind of the two approaches.
All right, so do you like the impromptu debates?
I've done impromptu debates before. I definitely like prepared ones more. I'm a big research guy. But I really respect like the skill that it has. I could never succeed competitively in impromptu. That's just not my skill set. But it's cool. And watching it is really fun because the speeches are just awesome and really entertaining.
Yeah. Tell me, I mean, you defined it as a Lincoln-Douglas debate. Of course, we know, right? Back in the 60s. So why is it defined as a Lincoln-Douglas debate?
Yeah, so Lincoln-Douglas debate started a few decades ago, and the idea of it is that they were going to model kind of this like civic discussion between teens, and because they're one-on-one unlike other debates, that's why it's modeled after the Lincoln-Douglas debates. The other defining feature of Lincoln-Douglas is that it's more philosophical conversations. If you look back historically to the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they weren't just about policy, they were also about broader philosophical issues, things like slavery. And now we definitely see that in contemporary Lincoln-Douglas debates, one of the central questions is the framework through which we should look at the resolution instead of just looking at policy issues alone. So on the right to strike, we'll have questions about, like, how should policy making happen? Should it be, like, a utilitarian analysis? Should it be something that's more based on, like ending oppression and structural violence? Should it be using, like, deontic ethics like Kant or something like that? These broader ethical questions are incorporated into Lincoln-Douglas debate, which is what makes it really different than other events.
All right. Well, tell me about the Gold Award you won in Minneapolis last month.
Yeah. So last month at the Minneapolis debate tournament, which was hosted online but would normally be in Minnesota, I took a gold bid to the Tournament of Champions, which basically means I'm halfway qualified to the TOC, which is the most prestigious high school debate tournament in the world. What makes that really significant is that no Lincoln-Douglas debater from the state of Utah has ever attended that tournament before, and I'm on track to get that full qualification. So it's a pretty big deal for Park City High School debate, and I'm really excited and hoping I get to go to that tournament.
Well, congratulations. So what does gold bid mean?
Yeah, so the way these tournaments function is the Tournament of Champions is run by the University of Kentucky, who determines the most prestigious tournaments in the country, and the top few debaters at each of those tournaments get a gold bid. And you need two gold bids to attend the Tournament of Champions. So I ranked in the top eight at Minneapolis, which qualified me for a gold bid, and I just need one more to go.
So do you have time to do that?
I've got, I think, four more tournaments this year with a chance, and I am optimistic for it.
So would you use the same debate that you've used before, or you need a new topic to do?
Yeah, so the topic we're currently on is for November and December. So I have one more tournament on that next weekend, and then we have a new topic for January and February, which is about the private exploration of space.
Okay. And then how did you do in the Minneapolis? Was there also a speech component to that?
There was no speech component to Minneapolis, but the last tournament I attended where I did impromptu was Skyhawk Smackdown, and it's hosted in Utah. I did pretty well in that as well. I took sixth overall. And what was really impressive was one of our novices actually took seventh place, which is really impressive because there were so many other competitors, and we were both able to like take really prestigious places in this tournament.
Great. Congratulations to you as well. So tell me, Park City High School, I mean, I think relatively small. Does that mean that you are in different category than other high schools than in the larger high schools in the state?
Unfortunately not. The way debate works is because it's a small enough community is we're really all competing against each other. And where that really shows up is on the national circuit, where it's us, where, like, I'm the only Lincoln Douglas debater at Park City High School who does national circuit debate. And it's me against these teams who have, you know, like 20 competitors and five coaches who are from these, like, very well-funded private schools. And it makes it really difficult to engage sometimes as a small school debater, especially on the national circuit, which I think makes Park City's competitive success far more impressive, is that not only are we among the upper echelon of national circuit debate teams, we're also doing it with considerably fewer debaters and just, like, less funding. Because, like, even though Park City has a lot of resources, like, we are a public school and we're from a state where debate isn't as good as it is in, like, California or New York.
Interesting. Now, you guys just had a tournament. Was it over this weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you guys do there? Did you both participate?
We both did, yes.
How'd you do, Grant?
I personally did have, not spectacular, but I did decent. I think the main point of the tournament for me was, like, learning from my mistakes and just, like, improving there. I do know Noam did very well at this tournament, though.
Yeah, I had a very close finish. I was one round away from getting my second gold bid to the Tournament of Champions. It was on a panel of three judges. Two voted for my opponent, one for me. So I was, like, quite literally one judge away from getting that qualification, which was tough. But it was a good tournament. I was against some of the best debaters from across the West Coast. And it was, I think I debated well. And even though I didn't get what I wanted, I'm still happy with how I debated.
Okay, so again, you've got four more chances, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we want to find out how you did. Is that something that you're on track for as well, getting into the Tournament of Champions?
That's personally not a goal for me personally. A more specific goal for me personally is, like, getting our team to be more inclusive, because what Noam was talking about with these bigger schools, right? These bigger schools have, like, a lot of funding, but the problem is that it's a very exclusionary event when you have schools that are like that, because all you want is a lot of funding and a lot of smart kids, and you only focus on them. What we're trying to do is include kids that aren't as, you know, well-versed in perhaps the argumentative side of debate or persuasive side of debate, and kind of include them into the mix to not only, you know, help our inclusivity in our community, but also to, like, get these kids out there and participating in this event too.
Yeah. So how are you doing that?
Well, for me personally, I'm, like, as a speech lead, because I'm a lead in my event, I'm taking the time to, like, sit down with each and every novice or, like, each and every member of my event and just, like, help them go over these events and answer any questions they have. And not only that, but recruit new people as well, because that's really the lifeline of debate. There's only 4 years that a competitor can compete. And once they've graduated high school, that's it. So what we need to do to continue our debate program is to recruit new people, right? Especially those that have, like, this massive potential for either, you know, argumentative debate or persuasive.
Yeah. So are there club fees involved? Is money an issue for students?
I don't believe money will be an issue because we have grants and we have the we have access to people that will fund these fees for those that can't afford them. So money is definitely not an issue in this case.
And to add on to what Grant was saying there, we've been doing Live PC, Give PC and all that fundraising. And the primary goal of those funds is to make debate more accessible for people. It can be a really elitist and expensive activity. But the goal of a lot of our funding is so we can cover those club fees, we can cover the travel fees when things go in person, cover our fees for really high quality coaching, so that money isn't an issue for joining the debate team.
Okay, you did pretty good. You raised over $15,000, Live PC, Give PC. Does that then, you say, helps other students, but who pays for your coach? Right? Because there's a cost to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, so the high school pays part of the coach's salary, but Live PC, Give PC also covers a portion of it, if I'm correct. That's one thing with debate, is that coaching is a super important part of it, just to have the highest quality instructors we can get. And so that funding is really important, so we can get instructors like Dr. Stewart, who's just incredibly well-versed in debate and so great to have on the team and just a really good competitive advantage for us.
Okay. People can contribute just by writing a check and then to the Park City High School Debate Club?
Yeah, that's correct.
Dropping it off at the high school?
Yep, that would work.
Yeah. Not only if people want to help our debate team, not only can they give money by writing a check to Park City High School Debate, but they can also donate in time. They can actually help judge these competitions, because in order to compete at these tournaments, you usually need a parent judge to like judge these rounds, because that's how these tournaments live, right? Oh. But some of these people don't have access to parents that can judge all the time because they're working or they're busy, etc. So if people do want to donate in other ways, they can offer up their time to help judge these tournaments.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't, because I just think you guys are way too smart for me. But I mean, in terms of being a judge, what do you have to know? What do you have to do?
I mean, you don't need to know much. All you need to know is that you leave your biases at the door, and all you're looking for are these like persuasive and argumentative kids, and who is the best at it. And we will give you training if you do decide to do judging and help contribute time to our team. So don't worry if you feel like you are inexperienced. You will gain experience from us training you and just simply judging.
Okay, you guys are very impressive. Anything else you want to add here?
I think something to say in general is we've definitely focused on some specific competitive achievements of the high school, but I also think it's important to say that as a whole, our team has been doing incredibly this season, especially some of our newer debaters show just an immense amount of potential, where they're competing at these national circuit and varsity level tournaments on the local circuit and having really impressive amounts of success. So the future of Park City Debate is looking really bright. But again, the most important thing for that is financial support, support with time, and just keeping kids in the activity.
More specifically, if you have any inquiries of like how you want to specifically help the debate team, you can email awilliams@pcschools.us. If you have any inquiries about like if you want to donate money, or if you want to judge for some of these tournaments, or you just want to ask like what is debate all about, she will give you like either one of our contact information, or she'd love to answer these questions for you to like get people more involved in debate, because that's what we're really trying to do here.
Okay, well, good luck to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Grant Murray and Noam Levinsky, again, two members of the Park City High School debate team. While county, state, and national health agencies want schools to promote COVID-19 vaccines, Park City School District taking a different approach. Michelle Dininger has this report.
In mid-November, the Park City School District Human Resources Department issued a memo to employees reminding them student medical information is private. The memo said employees can't ask if students are vaccinated, nor can employees express opinions about vaccines. Furthermore, staff can't initiate any discussion about vaccines, and they should redirect conversation if a student brings the subject up. But the Utah Department of Health strongly recommends schools encourage all staff and students 5 and older to get vaccinated. Public health recommendations are not laws. Schools can disregard them if they choose. But one of Utah's leading pediatricians says schools can play a valuable role in preventing the spread of COVID-19. One way to do that, he said, is vaccine clinics. Andy Pavia is the chief of pediatric infectious diseases for University of Utah Health. On Friday, he said it's more important than ever to vaccinate children in light of the new Omicron variant, and he regrets politics keep some people from protecting kids.
I wish people would listen to the majority of parents and do what's best for the majority of kids and not listen to those who shout the loudest. But sadly, I think sometimes it's the minority that shouts that influences what we do.
In Summit County, Health Director Phil Bondurant said local focus should be on the importance of vaccinating children and celebrating families who take that step. He declined to comment on the memo from the Park City School District. North and South Summit School District said Friday they don't have any policies that prevent employees from talking about vaccines. Several Park City teachers and parents reached out to KPCW to express concerns about the memo. Angela Anderson is a parent of two students in the district. She's also a scientist and director of Life Sciences Editors. She said public health issues have a place in classrooms.
I do agree that the discussions in class should focus on the curriculum, but I think that vaccines and public health initiatives are relevant and should be open to discussion, even and especially if they're uncomfortable. And I think that kids and teachers and the district should embrace that.
Park City School employees say they've been told not to speak to media. Teachers discussed the new policy with KPCW on condition of anonymity. They strongly agreed that students should not be asked their vaccination status, but said that's already a well-established part of educational privacy law. One asked why teachers should not discuss public health data, because it makes sense to discuss vaccines in terms of statistics and data analysis, which is the crux of science education. Another teacher took issue with the part of the memo that said vaccines are not in the core curriculum, saying they have an obligation to teach historical and current science, and vaccines are part of that. A third teacher told KPCW they worry about speaking off the cuff and getting in trouble, and said they feel they're doing students a disservice by not talking about current events, which could be a huge lesson on how to interact with others. Brad Assay, president of Utah's chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, which represents 10 teachers in the Park City School District, said avoiding vaccine talk in schools is not about educational privacy, but rather about science and speech.
If you have a student in class that has a question about the vaccines based on science, that a teacher is not allowed to answer their questions. That is wrong. We get questions all the time as teachers. Does the vaccine really work? We should be able to say, based on science, it's been proven that the vaccine is efficient at minimizing the risk of contracting the virus. So the safest way to avoid COVID is to be vaccinated. They can't even say that.
Assay said avoiding vaccine talk at schools is aimed at placating anti-vax, anti-science groups, and teachers he represents don't feel safe. School district officials and board members did not respond to requests for comment for this report.